This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Good morning, Catherine Collette, she of recently returned from the castle. How are you going?
I know. The only thing I can think of is Maid Marian, but it Maid Catherine doesn't really have the same ring.
Not quite, but you could totally do it. Tell me in brief, how was the dungeon room?
It was so good. We didn't actually, Carney and I didn't go into the dungeon room. They do have this is sort of the only bit I feel slightly bad about. They have a medieval torture museum that Tilly and her friend went into and didn't see the sign that said, you've got to be 13 to go in. Both of them are 12. They came out, like the two of them were not pale, but definitely affected by the experience. And multiple times throughout the weekend, they were like, did you know they used to wear this boot filled with oil?
Oh, my God.
Hot oil. So
did you get a phone call from the parent at the other end?
Not yet. I think Tilly's more the one that will that would have long-term issues as a result of it. But she seems okay.
Do you know torture museums in particular were the favourite cultural institution of choice for my best friend Erica and I when we did our one-year backpacking when we were 19. That was always what we went to, the torture museums.
There absolutely is something very, very fascinating about torture. This one, though, because I did like that as a kid. I think people always found torture and superstitions very interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I didn't go into this one. Maybe there were elements that were a little too graphic from the way, and there were tortures that I had never heard of. Like, you know, there was a lot of stocks, obviously, around Crowell Castle.
We have. Did you put your heads in the stocks?
Yes. Yes. There's lots. We got multiple photos of different sets of kids that we owned, you know. But that was super fun. There was a like a rack that you could kind of hang off and get a photo with that. There was a guillotine that obviously didn't slide, but you could pose with that. Those ones were all outside. But I think the heavy stuff was in the torture museum.
Oh,
but having said that, so much fun. We had such a good time. It like everything about the weekend just seemed to work. And I think I am now Crowell Castle's number one fan.
And clearly doing
ambassador.
clearly an ambassador. Let's just go back for a second. What was the podcast? It was Hamish's podcast, yeah, that you originally listened to?
It was Hamish's podcast around dadding. Yes. How Other Dads Dad, and it was an interview with Rob Stitch, and he talked about going to Crowell Castle, which I had never even heard of.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have heard of. I have mentioned it multiple times now, and I struggle to find someone our-ish age who hasn't heard of Crowell Castle,
yeah,
so I think
absolutely.
I'm in the minority there. I mean, it's a funny little spot. It's about 15 minutes from Ballarat. It is small. So if you've been to Magic Mountain, it's got a similar vibe to Magic Mountain. It's the kind of place where in the middle there's picnic tables and things. The best bit about it, I think, is that even a pair of 10-year-olds and a pair of 8-year-olds, you feel very comfortable with them walking around by themselves. Probably should have had a boundary.
Except
with
for the torture museum.
The torture museum. But you can literally find them in 5 minutes. There's a maze that the kids really enjoyed going in.
I love
in.
A maze.
Maze is great. Maze only goes up to my shoulders.
Oh,
so
perfect.
You really can find them.
Can
in
you
a few
lock
minutes.
Them in there? That would be fun.
Good.
So from Rob Sitch's original thing, which was letting the kids decide what the new adventure is, have you got a plan for the next adventure in your household?
No, I do not have a plan, but I, or not one that they've been involved in, but I did buy a secondhand outdoor movie projector. I saw this thing on Instagram where we have a good trampoline in the backyard and it's on wheels, like it's a big proper one, but you have a movie projector, you cover the trampoline in like doonas and pillows and all that sort of stuff and make it really cozy in the trampoline, and then you have a movie, like a movie night, and the trampoline is that, super cool. So I can lend you the projector once it arrives.
I just want an invitation. Can't you just take my kids?
Oh, yeah, we could do that too. That's probably easier. But Kryl, like, super fun. Oscar was just saying yesterday, A, how much he liked being able to walk around by himself, but he's like, can we go back? Well, I don't think we could go back for a while. Like,
Kryl, just so you know, Catherine Collette and family are ready to be your ambassador for 2024. We'll check back in. If dear listeners, you and your family end up going to Kryl Castle, please do let us know how we are impacting your travel plans.
And if you go, the number one thing to see is the jousting. The jousting is genuinely cool.
So do you get to have a go?
You get to have a go at axe throwing.
Okay, nice.
If you can imagine a normal axe, put that out of your mind and then imagine something much smaller, more lightweight, thinner and blunter.
Like a hatchet.
And maybe a hatchet. It is quite hatchet-like. You can muck around and throw that, quite fun. But the jousting is incredible. And one of the jousters, so they are dressed as knights and they're riding around on horses. Obviously, they have these big sticks. Kind of a weird and ridiculous thing. They ride at each other and kind of the stick breaks. I think the stick must be made of something like balsa wood. I don't know if that's historically accurate or not. But one of the jousters, they went through his bio or the sort of jousting that he had done. I think he's like one of the best jousters in the world. He's jousted. Of course, medieval people, there's a thing around medieval stuff. So he had competed in multiple countries and he was very good.
Jousting, I taught when back in my teaching days, I taught A Knight's Tale for year eights as as one of our texts. And my Lord, it was so fun. And Heath Ledger with those.
Oh my God.
Jousting. What do you call the thing? The jouster? The joust? What do you call it?
It is called the joust. Yeah. They did in a nod to that, they said that we were going to sing the national anthem, but it was We Will Rock You.
God, such a good movie. That is one, actually, I haven't watched that with the kids yet. That would be a good one to watch with the kids. Okay, adding to list, A Knight's Tale. So now that we've covered off Kryl Castle, we did ask yesterday on the socials if there were any questions that we could cover for our dear listeners, and a few have come in. We'll see if we can get through all of these. So the first one is from Isabella, who wanted to hear more about publishing other types of books, specifically poetry and short story. Now, we don't necessarily have experience ourselves in this, but we've talked to people who do.
Yes, we have talked to so many people, particularly in the short story space, but in poetry as well. Some that come to my mind, Kate Kennedy, there's a master's episode with her. Anne Casey Hardy, her book, Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls, such a good book.
We Tony both Birch, love that.
Yeah, such a good book. So I reckon some of the past interviews would be a good place to start. A short story collection that I really mourn the loss of. Do you remember the old Sleepers Almanacs?
Yes.
Oh, yes. God, they were absolutely brilliant. I did think, though, Mark Smith, maybe, and Jock Sarong have been doing editing of short story collections. Is that right? You did contribute to one of those.
No, I haven't contributed yet, but our dear friend Emily Bruin, I know, is in the upcoming one, which are it's the Frio Press collection. I think the upcoming one is in response to Nick Cave. Yeah, there is coming up later this year. I think in November is the Melbourne launch, so people should look at that. I think if this is helpful, Isabella, that there are so many opportunities for the publication of short stories and poetry through lit mags or competitions. So that's something that's really important to look out for. And I would say that many of those people we've talked to, and I'm thinking too about Susie Anderson, who we recently featured for her debut. Yes. That they often have published one or more of the poems. Twi On is another one with her great collections of poetry. And she talked to us for the Conversations with Friends series during COVID. They've often published some of those poems or short stories elsewhere, particularly in Lit Mags, before they go into the final collection. So that might be something worth thinking about.
Another consideration, particularly if you're starting out, is a lot of council areas do lit competitions, and they can be a good first in. They'll often put together an anthology each year based on submissions.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as having a prize and all the rest of it.
Yeah. So hopefully that is in some way useful, Isabella. We'll put links to all of those past episodes in the show notes. The next one is from Canberra Bells on Instagram.
Canberra Bells. I'm going to read Bells. This one.
Okay.
So after the success of The Hummingbird Effect, what does starting over feel like? Very topical, because we were just chatting about starting over.
We were just chatting about starting over. And like, I love, Canberra Bells, that you have assumed that I have got started on my new project, but I actually have this week. So I feel like I can speak to this. It feels so exciting. And I think that it feels so exciting. And when I say got it getting started, like I've had the idea for the new novel before I finished Hummingbird Effect. It came from a real life thing that happened to me. So what I've got so far are kind of is my journal, which I always have just with notes. I have actually got now behind me on the wall, I've got like a character map in development. And I've just got some notes, and I had to put together for something I was applying for this week, just a 5-page sample of writing. And so I just expanded out these tiny little notes I had, and it felt fun. And I read out some of the, like, I don't know, maximum 1500 words, but I read out some of those words to my partner because he was around, and it just felt exciting to get into something new.
Really? You read them out to Adam?
Yeah, because I had written them so quickly and I needed to hand the thing in that was my best way to my best way to edit quickly.
Yeah, to hear it.
Yeah, but I'm super excited. And in terms of what it looks like, so excitement is what it feels like. I've built up a real head of steam to get going on this one. And what it looks like is that I am now specifically blocking out time in chunks for the rest of this year, and more specifically in the first half of 2024, to really put aside time to get cracking on this one.
So this is something I'm grappling with at the moment, is you do or have historically done big chunks. Is that when you say you're putting aside time, is that a weekly put aside, or is that a, I'm going to hit it hard for a week here and then I'm going to hit it hard for a week here? What does that look like?
More like I'm going to hit it hard for a week here, hit it hard for a week there. I've been looking up to see if Sarah Centilles has got her word caved out dates out for next year. So locking in time that is, I think I find it much easier when I have booked something, especially if I've paid for something like an Airbnb, or I've, you know, paid for an online writing retreat. It becomes immovable in my calendar. And that's really what I need, because I am a yes person, which I'm trying hard to not be so yes in 2024. And so that means that I know that that period of time is locked down. And then I don't feel so bad about those little bits of work, that kind of procrastination, you know, and the Google deep diving and things like that, because I know I'm leading up to these big chunks of time where I traditionally have got a lot of words down, at least.
First words? Like,
yeah. I think for first words, I need the retreat time. I find I can do editing and redrafting and things like that easier from home. But yeah, that's what it looks like at the moment.
Okay. Maybe that's the answer. The eternal search for the right way.
The eternal search for the right way. Haven't we discovered over 6 years of talking to people that there is no correct way?
It feels appealing though, I reckon, retreat. I have a retreat coming up, and I can already, you just mentally slotting things
Yes.
Into it. Like, it makes you feel relaxed going, well, I couldn't get time today, or I can't get much time this week, but I've got this big chunk. And
yes. Yeah. And you know, like, it feels like it could be, okay, you know, you've put aside a big chunk and I'm just going to write. But I think you do this as well, Catherine. I'm very structured about how I spend that time. Like, I have itemized to-do lists. I have a big kind of aim for the period of time. So, like, where I might get to, and the big overall kind of aim of what I might do. So whether it be a certain number of words or a certain character or getting to this part in the story. And then I literally break it down to when I will get up, when I will have breakfast, when I will walk, and when I will do writing sessions.
Yeah, me too.
Jane,
well, it's just so precious, isn't it?
It's so precious. It's so precious. Now, Jane has asked two things. Her first was about asking me how I ended up doing my PhD, and she would love to hear more about that. I'm going to answer this very quickly and as honestly as I can. I was invited to apply for a PhD. So I hadn't necessarily been working up a topic or a question. It was something that I'd expressed interest in before. And I was invited to do it. And the only reason that I said yes is because I ended up getting a scholarship. So I want to be very, very clear on the fact that while the PhD has been amazing for my process and my brain and my community and the things that I have learnt, I also would not have done it had I not had the scholarship to go alongside it, because for me, that was kind of like getting Australia Council funding or Creative Vic funding. Like, it has allowed me to write, study full time, where I would not have been able to do that otherwise. So that's my kind of very frank answer to that.
So when they approached you, was the scholarship part, like, did you have to apply for a scholarship?
Yeah, no, I absolutely had to apply. So that wasn't granted. But but I think that I would have, had I been successful in applying for the PhD but not successful in applying for the scholarship, I would have said, I can't do it at this point in time.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, and
it's hard even with a scholarship, isn't it?
Like, yeah, absolutely. And I have been on leave from the PhD while I've been touring the book, because it's just would have been absolutely impossible to do that. And I have actually also renegotiated the terms of it. So before, I was doing a practice research based PhD, which meant I was looking at things kind of about practice itself, creative practice itself, and not necessarily about the novel. But I have renegotiated that partly because of time and workload to be a straight kind of creative writing PhD in the same place with my same supervisors. But now the novel is part of it, and then the exegesis will be on the writing of the novel. So,
and the novel being The Hummingbird Effect?
Or, yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So that, I hope that answers that question. That is my frank response. Jane also cannot stop laughing about Catherine's partner, Carney, doing a workout with the car guy, which is a moment from last week's episode that I completely forgot about, but then cracked up laughing about. Has there been more visits to the car guy?
There have not been more visits. He does say he'll pass through the area and drop by, say hi. We'll see what happens.
I was also thinking about Carney's fishing trip, because I was speaking to my bestie this week and she was sitting close to her partner, who is also my best friend, and talking about how he'd been fishing in the afternoons in Broome. They live up in the Kimberley, and they've been on holidays. And I said, well, has he been catching anything and bringing it back in? And she said, no, he doesn't bring anything back in. And he was very quick and clear to jump in and say, this is specifically catch and release fishing. I'm not attempting to bring anything in. And it just made me think about Carney and the very particular feelings some fishing people have about what they are attempting to do and their success rate in doing it. It was very funny.
I can imagine the speed of that clarification. Like,
straight in there. Yeah. Straight in there.
Immediate.
We have some patrons to thank because
we do.
They're amazing.
Yeah, a massive thank you to Erica Wagner for becoming one of our new patrons, and a rethank
A rethank, a
thanks again.
A thanks again, a more thanks to you.
A additional gratitude to Catherine Wilson and Meg Dunley, who are existing patrons but have increased their level of patronage.
Which is amazing. And we know, as I know when I'm doing my accounts, that, you know, patronage, you lot being patrons is not something that we take for granted. We are so glad. We totally understand when you have to jump out for a while. And we also appreciate it if you up that for a little bit. It's just thank you, thank you, thank you.
It's very generous and we know you don't have to do it. So, yeah, echo that. Thanks.
I saw some of the debut crew 2023 in person last week because they came along to my discussion with Anna Kate Blair at Beau Morris Library, which was fantastic. Also, Beau Morris is on the sea, Catherine.
And I know, Beau Morris is great. I've swum there.
Yes, really, because you go to the bay a lot. I was just gobsmacked. I knew kind of intellectually that I was going to Bayside, but seeing it on a beautiful, balmy, you know, night was something different. Anyway, Anna Kate Blair is part of the debut crew. Other people who were there were Danny Scrimshaw, Katja Ariel, Cassie Polame. There was someone else as well I'm going to forget, but it was fantastic to see them. And excitingly, we have a whole new bunch of reels that we'll be putting out on the podcast, on our socials this week and next, because there's so many debut crew 2023 people left to go.
Yeah, impressive group, right?
So impressive. For people who are debuting in 2024, because we know a bunch of you have got in touch, Lisa Kenway is the person to get in touch with, who has a debut book coming out in 2024, and she has delightfully put out on the socials that she is getting together a new debut crew 2024. So get in touch with Lisa. We'll put links to how you can do that in the show notes. But yes, yeah, stay tuned to the socials this week. What was amazing about the last lot of reels that we did for the debut crew is just the sharing and the love for them. That was so impressive. So thank you to our listeners for doing that and community. And please get behind and give some love to the new lot coming up.
Yeah, that's cool. Moving on. Kate, what have you been reading?
Oh, I have been doing so much reading because I have been at home for a little bit and I really loved it. I have just finished the new one from Sally Hepworth.
Oh, this is my read as well. So good.
Have you already finished it?
No, I think I've got about 10% left.
Oh my gosh, so what do you think?
It's so good. It is tense from the very first sentence. She just gets better and better. I think I've read all of Sally's books. I love them all. This one I was holding off until Christmas. I was going to read it by the beach, you know, beach read type of thing. I couldn't wait. I bought it on Kindle and have been burning through it.
And then when you start it, you like, I think I did it in two sittings, like two nights in a row. It is so good. I think she does. I was trying to work out what the genre is. I've called it page turning, character based thrillery things. I don't think that is an actual genre.
Domestic is often in there.
Yes.
Something domestic in there. So this one is set around three sisters, not sisters by blood, but they grew up for a period of time together in a foster home, which was not a very nice place to be. So we hear a bit about that backstory. And then in the front story, there's a body been found at this foster home. So it's the kind of unpacking of what happens. It's just so well done.
It's so well done. And I'm really interested because I get the chance to talk to Sally with Amy Lovett this week coming for Literary Listings' first literary lunch. It's a complete sellout. There's been more seats added and they've all sold out as well. So you can't come to it. It's booked out. Good for you if you got a ticket.
It's a solid event. It's like a
fancy. But I'm so looking forward to talking to her because I know already just from a little bit of the reading that I've been doing that she did a lot of interviews and research with people who have lived experience of foster care as well. And the subject matter is dark. You know, and what I was thinking as I finished it would be really, really interesting to see is this novel, Darling Girls, paired with Jennifer Downes's Miles Franklin winning Bodies of Light, which, disclaimer, I have not read, but I do know that it deals with the same kind of subject matter. And I think it would just be really interesting to see a panel on a festival with someone like Sally and someone like Jen paired together, not only looking at the writing experience of both researching and writing the kind of trauma that they've written through these foster experiences, but also in looking at the way those two books were packaged for readers. So they're very different books. You know, Sally's is already topping the commercial fiction charts. Jennifer's obviously won the Miles Franklin, critically acclaimed, but very much packaged as high literature. I'd just be really interested to see a festival pairing those two together and having those two writers talk about the differences and the similarities perhaps in writing that kind of content and how they did it. I think that would be
cool. You can tell that Sally has done research for this book because there's moments that are really sticky as a reader. There's one point at which one of the characters is working in the foster care system as a social worker, so placing foster kids into families. And this boy makes a comment that his foster parent is allowing him to stay on for a little while beyond being 18. And he says, "Oh, I'm so lucky." And she says to him, "You're not lucky. This is this is a basic expectation you should have in life."
It gets you in all the spots. I think the other thing about Hepworth is that, like someone like Toni Jordan, she just understands plot so deeply in her bones. And so as a reader, what that translates to for me is having this, is feeling very confident that, you know, I know where things
are constantly revealed.
Constantly tense.
But I'm in a good state of tension.
Yeah. And could not pick, you know, did not pick it. If that, you know, makes sense. Did not pick it. Like, she's always got something left in the tank. So that was very impressive. So Darling Girls was my first. My second this week, which I've just posted about on Instagram, is an extraordinary little book. It's called Kick the Latch. It's by Catherine Scanlon, and who's a US writer, and I've talked about Catherine Scanlon before, maybe at the start of this year, because Penny Russin gave me the first book of hers that I read. It was called August 9 Fog, and it was fragments from a diary that the author had found in a yard sale and kind of placed together almost like poetry. It's a tiny, tiny little book, but I was absolutely delighted by the book and by the kind of story behind it. So Kick the Latch is, it's fiction, but it's based on interviews that Scanlon did with a horse trainer called Sonia from the Midwest. And so it's just these little fragments of story in Sonia's voice, about her growing up and her experience of being a trainer and living this kind of sometimes often very precarious, often violent life among men mostly and horses. The character studies as themselves would be so good for either writers looking at writing character and voice specifically, or writers who are teachers as well. Like, they are just, the sentences are extraordinary. The way that Scanlon does voice is extraordinary. I just highly recommend it. It's one of those books that you say, this is a book for writers who will read it as a writer. Do you have those kinds of ones?
I love that. That's a great recommendation. I have no more reading. I have a listening recommendation. I know that you have listened to this one as well. It is That Rom-Com Pod.
I love it.
Relatively new podcast. It's hosted by Claire Fletcher and Karina May. I think maybe they're at 4 or 5 episodes, something like that. I love everything about it. I love the dynamic between those two, but also the concept of it. So each episode is framed around a romantic comedy trope. I can now think of no tropes. Enemies to lovers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fake dating, forced proximity, these kinds of things. So they talk about that trope. They talk about books and films and different things that employ that trope. They also, and I love that we're seeing this in different places now, they look at a very well-known romantic comedy and kind of consider it under the modern lens of, you know, would this hold up today? So for an example might be Bridget Jones's Diary, obviously a very famous and a great romantic comedy. What I love about them going back to these books is often I've read them when they actually came out in the 90s or at the time. Yeah. So you have this sort of experience of what it was like that first time, and then they sort of come back to it with a new lens. Bridget Jones in particular is really interesting because obviously it's very beloved. I think it spawned many, many other similar types and styles of book. But it has this one thing in there that is very particular to Australia, I think, maybe to certain other countries, in that Bridget would always record her weight when she wrote in the diary, which was such a 90s thing, the kind of the pressure of thinness and all of those sorts of things. But because she was British and she was recording it in pounds, reading it as an Australian, you never knew what her weight really was.
Yeah.
Like, I do remember that experience really well. Like, you wouldn't, you know, they point out the fact that she's actually a pretty normal weight, but you would sort of, you didn't have the impact of
that's interesting.
Someone's weight and that comparison sort of thing, which is something that they raised within one of the episodes. I thought it was a really good point.
I think it's so, I've been listening to it too. It was what I wanted to give a shout out to today in terms of listening. And I think it's, you know, it's essential listening for anyone who's writing rom-coms, just because of all that background, because of the way they're re-examining things, but also because they really break it down. And as a person who doesn't necessarily write rom-coms, or who doesn't at all, but who reads them and enjoys them, it has been fantastic to see the language used to describe those tropes and those different things as well. Like, I'm finding that really, really interesting. And the way too in which they both are able to break down how they employ those kinds of things in their own books and in their own writing. Yeah, hard recommend from me for that rom-com pod. I loved it. On reading, our featured book today is a debut middle grade all about dance. Have a listen. Today's featured book is brought to you by Fremantle Press. I'm delighted to be speaking to debut novelist Shanae Maripodi about her middle grade novel, One Wrong Turn. Shanae is a children's author and journalist based in Perth, Western Australia. She's worked in the media industry for almost a decade and is currently a producer for Channel 9 News. She's also worked as a reporter for Channel 7's Today Tonight, as well as in online news and radio. Shanae is also an experienced MC and, delightfully, the host of the Writers Off the Page podcast. One Wrong Turn is her debut middle grade novel. Congratulations, Shanae, and welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. It's so exciting to be here.
So, Shanae, to begin where we always do, can you please give us the pitch for One Wrong Turn?
I can. So One Wrong Turn is a middle grade novel. It's set in an elite ballet school and it follows two girls as they go head to head for the lead role in their production of Cinderella. Now, one of those girls is 14-year-old Amelia, and she'll tell you she's the hardest working dancer at the academy and she's very talented and she wants to follow in her parents' footsteps and become a professional ballerina. And she's a shoo-in for the lead role until new talent comes along. And that's Valentina, who's just arrived from Italy. So while Amelia's sole focus is perfection and achieving it, Valentina's juggling a new country, trying to navigate a new language, and a family that doesn't really understand the demands that come with an elite ballet academy. And amongst all of this, someone tells one very big unnecessary lie that has the potential to ruin everything.
It's a great premise, great book, very exciting reading. I didn't have to dive very far to find out that you have a whole life of dance behind you, Shanae. Can you please share with us a little of your history with dance and where the specific seed for this novel came from?
Yeah, sure. So I started dancing when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I have to confess to people that I'm not anywhere as talented as my characters. I'm kind of living vicariously through them now.
Perfect.
Because it's just fabulous. It's like my dance mom moment. So I grew up in local dance schools and did the end of year performances, the exams and the competitions. So I very much know the stresses and pressures that come with being part of a dance school, and how also a big thing for me is how your dance school becomes like a second family, because you spend so much time there and you're in each other's pockets and you know each other so well. So I really wanted to play with that idea. But for me, it was really, I feel like growing up, I read a lot of dance novels whenever I could find them, and they were always beautiful, but that was always the thing. They were beautiful, and it was very much the glitz and glamour of ballet. And I felt like as a kid, there were the sporty kids and everyone knew they were really athletic and that they trained hard. But us dance kids, everyone kind of just acted like, well, yeah, you go to dancing, you prance around, you have a bit of fun. And that's really what it was. And if you weren't training to be a professional, like I was never training to be a professional, no one really got what you did. So I really wanted to explore that athleticism of dance, that yes, it's a beautiful art, it's stunning, and the job of a dancer is to make it look effortless on stage, but there's a lot that goes on to make sure it looks that way.
I really loved the physicality of the writing, and you could tell if you'd not read anything about you, you could tell that you've got that experience in dance because you can feel it on the page. There's the bleeding toes. I come from a dancing background too and can so remember those details. But also what really struck me as I was reading it is that discipline, the training, the competition even really applies to kids in all kinds of different fields and different sports as well. So I can see that it will appeal to readers beyond ballet schools and to those who are in other competitive sports as well. Do you feel that?
I really hope so. And that's always a really big driver for me. I love taking those characters that are just incredibly determined and will stop at nothing to achieve, I guess, their goals. And that applies to, like you said, absolutely to anything. And whenever I go to schools now, I've just done a whole string of book week, and I've talked about how, you know, dancers work and they don't necessarily get what they want straight away, but they have to keep going until they achieve, not perfection, because that's a moving target, but get to where they want to be. And it's very applicable to writing as well. And I feel like when I'm saying it, I'm like, it's very much like publishing a book. You just keep on going because there's nothing else you want to do, because you've got to achieve it.
Mm. I noted in your acknowledgements that you thanked your mum and dad who you said used to edit the stories you wrote in primary school, and that your mum always said you'd be a children's author. Can you tell us about the writing you were doing as a young person and when you knew that you wanted to be a writer when you grew up?
Yeah, so it was funny. So I started writing in primary school, and for me, that was my idea of a good time. So if I wasn't reading a book, I was writing my own. And it's funny because now I look back at it and I'm really proud of myself, and I'm like, that's so awesome that you're disciplined to do that. But at the time I wasn't very cool. Like, other kids did not think that was a cool thing to be doing. But I started writing, it was a full-length novel, I've still got them now, called The Rebel Riders, that was very much a cross between The Saddle Club and The Famous Five, these four girls on horseback that went and solved mysteries because I desperately wanted a horse. So that was probably the closest I was going to get my imaginary world. And I finished a full draft of a novel, and Mum had edited it over her breakfast each morning. And I went on to write a second one because I thought, this is going to be a full series. And Mum and Dad actually, they met someone from Fremantle Press, or they knew someone who knew somebody, so they submitted it. And being 11 or 12 at the time, I very quickly was thinking, you know, I'm going to be a famous author, I'm going to tour the world, I'm going to be a millionaire, this is amazing. And then, of course, got the kindest rejection letter that I've ever seen, and I've still got it because I like to look at it occasionally. And it was that from there, I always had this goal that I really wanted to publish a book. But I can distinctly remember a lot of adults saying to me, oh, aim to publish a book, but don't aim for it to be a career. It's very much a hobby. It's something you do on the side. So that's how I fell into journalism, because it was storytelling and writing and, it seemed a little bit more of a career apparently than writing books. But
I love that. I love that so much. And I love you still have that letter. I always enjoy when we're talking to writers and they've kept those early reminders of the validation of wanting to be a writer.
Well, I've still got printouts of the manuscript because back then obviously you had to send it in. So there's these big chunks of A4 paper. And funnily enough, I've also got floppy disks that have them on it because I wanted to keep the work really safe. So it's so safe that I can't access it now.
No, that is really an incredible archive. Sinead, tell us, so early experience, you've submitted to Fremantle Press already at 11 years of age. You go on to become a journalist. When did the desire come back? What was your path to publication with this book, One Wrong Turn?
Well, the desire was always there, but I was one of those annoying people that was like, oh, I want to write a book, but I don't have time. And I say annoying lightly because I get it. Like, everyone is so busy and it is that thing. It eats up a lot of time. And I remember a colleague of mine saying to me, I think I just said it in passing one day, and he was like, oh, Sinead, it's obviously not really a priority because if it was, you'd make the time. And he just said it really bluntly. And I was like, oh my God, you're so right. And I laugh now because I tell him about it. And I say, you know, I'm really glad you gave me that kick up the bum. And he's like, geez, that was really rude of me to say that. And I'm like, no, it was so right, because we make time for everything that's important to us. And why not something like this? So a few years ago, I started carving out time, started doing a couple of courses, and just chipped away. And it was very much, I laugh when you mention the acknowledgements and mum saying that I'd be a children's author. I actually always thought I'd be an adult author. And it was just every time I'd dabble a little bit through uni in writing, it was always adult. And mum just kept saying, she's like, I just think you need to be a children's author. I just feel it whenever I'm around you. And I thought, that's such a stupid thing to say. How do you know? And so when I decided to get back into writing this time, it was just that write what you know type premise. And I thought, okay, all I know is I know dance pretty well. Let's dive in here. And the voices were just of 14-year-olds that came out. So it was a very natural fall into middle grade rather than me thinking to myself, I want to write for this age group because. And so for a couple of years, I tinkered away really slowly at One Wrong Turn. It was actually called Bunheads at the time because people nicknamed ballet dancers, yeah, Bunheads. And it wasn't until I fell pregnant actually and was quite sick with morning sickness and just put everything to the side. And it wasn't until my son was 8 months that I suddenly thought, you know, now's a good time because I don't have that other excuse of I don't want to go on the computer because I've been on the computer all day. I'm not on the computer. So whenever he was asleep, I was in the study writing just to keep it going. And the more I did that, the more it became a little bit of an obsession because I thought, you know, I've given up sleep. Like people tell you when the baby sleeps, you sleep. I'm giving that up. I need to see this through to the end. So I just really started pushing. I launched my podcast then because I think I'm a sucker for punishment, but I also felt like I needed to research. And I was like, this is a great way to network and I can ask the questions I want to ask. So I was doing all of that in nap times and started submitting the first, it wasn't the first draft, it was very, very polished. I had worked on it for a long time. And it was kind of, not crickets, but I just had this niggle that something just wasn't right with it. And I had Amelia, one of the lead characters, she was always a lead character, but I had another girl that was up front. And I just didn't feel like I fully understood her, which saying it now is quite an obvious red flag, but at the time, because I had polished the book so much, I really thought I'd gotten past that. And so when Fremantle Press actually rejected it, but because I had spoken to them before, they said, oh, we're happy to have a chat to you about it. And that flag was already in my mind. So I kind of said to them, was that an issue for you? And they're like, yeah, to be honest, we just didn't really vibe with it. But there was this background character. And I was like, yeah, right, the Italian? And they're like, yes. And I was like, I've already been thinking about her. She was really loud in my head and she was a lot of fun. And I thought, and I was, this was in the conversation to Kate from Fremantle Press. I said, what do you think would happen if I brought her to the front? And instead, at the time, she was just, she was an Australian with Italian heritage, much like myself. And I thought, what happens if I bring her to the front and I make her a migrant just so she's got a little bit more of a story? And I was talking it through with Kate because I had given it some thought before we had our little meeting, because I thought if I'm going to get this time to chat to a publisher, I really want to make sure I'm going in and kind of giving it my all. And I talked Kate through it and I was like, you know, it would be a little bit like Looking for Ella Brandy meets Dance Academy, just those cultural vibes of Looking for Ella Brandy.
Yeah.
And Kate's like, oh, I really like the sound of that. She's like, go away and have a tinker. And then said, I'd love to read it when you're done if you want, if I want. Like, I'm not going to send it to a publisher who wants to. And I just jumped because I thought, you know, this is a conversation that's very fresh. I want to deliver quickly so that I'm still fresh, hopefully, in Kate's mind because she sees so much. So it was just ahead of NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month. And so that was my target. NaNoWriMo was to write a full first draft rewritten. And I changed everything from third to first person as well to make it closer because for some reason this Italian voice in my head, it was always in first person. It was much closer. And it just all of a sudden came to life. So it was a very easy first draft to write. And then I spent December polishing it. And then I think mid-January I resubmitted and it was just such a difference. I all of a sudden got a call and, and they were like, yep, let's go ahead. We love it.
Oh.
And so it was just, I remember telling my husband when I was thinking about doing this rewrite and he was just like, are you sure? Like you've really put a lot of work into this. This isn't a first draft. He goes, you know, it's subjective. Why don't you send it elsewhere? And I was like, nah, because now I've got this idea that it's not right. I can't. I need to change it. And so, yeah, thankfully it paid off.
I love that story, Sinead, and because it speaks to so many things. A, your persistence in going back, your capacity and your willingness to listen to the feedback from the publisher and be really on board with that. And, yes, that niggle that you were already aware of, which is, I think Charlotte Wood would say that's the novel telling you how it wants to be written.
Yeah.
You know, that you followed your intuition with that.
Well, I laugh now because the story, of course, is about dancers who want to be front and centre in the spotlight. And I'm like, I shouldn't have been surprised that I had a background dancer that wanted to come to the front.
Exactly. Oh, that's fantastic. That's such a great story. You mentioned the podcast then, your Writers Off the Page podcast. What are some of the most significant moments or advice or things you've taken from the conversations you've had on that podcast?
I think the biggest thing for me now, I'm actually in the moment taking a tiny break just while I get my head around publicity for One Wrong Turn. But it's just the generosity of the writing community. And I mean, whether it's somebody who's released their debut novel or one of our best sellers, everyone is just so willing to share their story, to give advice. Conversations go long after I stop recording.
Yes.
And it's reassuring that no matter where authors are in their career, everyone's kind of grappling with the same things. And sometimes I find it a little bit nerve-wracking that best-selling authors are still feeling incredibly insecure because I'm like, geez, as a bunch, we're not overly confident.
The imposter syndrome goes deep and long.
and hearing about other rejections and authors saying, you know, I had three or four books out and then I hit a stump and got rejections and didn't move forward. And knowing that that happens, that's kind of been the big thing for me, that going, okay, this is a really, really hard industry across the board. So I can afford to be a bit more gentle on myself because it's not just me coming across these things.
Mm. Sinead, I'm interested. You've got the podcast. You've obviously got a small human at home. You've got your work as a journalist and you've got your writing. You're obviously not getting all of that just in nap time anymore. How are you balancing the juggle? How are you getting the writing done?
Look, not always well, to be honest with you. the juggle is, it's manic. And I'm always reassessing. I'm part-time as a journalist now, but that's part-time because of my son. Unfortunately, it's not I've made so much money as an author, I'm stepping back. So it is still, unfortunately, the days I'm in the office, that's office days. I am, because I'm producing the news at the moment, I don't start until 10 o'clock. And so I do try and get my mum, I'm very lucky, she picks up my little boy quite early, and I'll get maybe an hour just before I go to work, and I'll try and slam out some words then. And then those other days, it very much is still in the gap. So it's, we're down to, my son turns 3 this month, and we're down to an hour nap at best, and that's not consistent.
When and those so naps go.
I know. I've gotten very good, and from the get-go, because he was never a good sleeper at all, and part of it was a little bit insane me deciding to jump on this writing thing, because we were absolutely in the trenches in his first year. It was, I feel terrible saying it, it was awful. It was really bad. But he would just wake up after anywhere from 15 minutes to maybe an hour and 15 minutes. And so I just got really good at writing like a bomb was going to explode at any moment. And that hasn't left me yet. So I can get a lot done in his hour nap time. Sometimes I'll do a tiny bit at night, but I don't switch off very well. So I have to really need to do that. And sometimes that's more, I'll do publicity things at night or not actual writing. And lately it's been very flat out. So I've been taking a couple of hours each day on the weekend, and my husband's been taking a little one out of the house. But it's, I'm always reassessing, because it's very much a in the gaps type thing. And these past couple of months were really hard around book week, preparing writing workshops, author talks, publicity, sequel writing. It's just, there's a lot going on, and I don't know. I haven't got it, Kate.
No, do any of us
just paddling wildly?
Do any of us ever have it? You dropped some very exciting news into there that one of the things you're currently juggling is a sequel to One Wrong Turn. Congratulations! Yeah.
Thank you.
Obviously, we can expect that at some time in the future. How's that all going for you? And what have been maybe the different challenges or anything easier in writing the sequel?
So crazy is just the word that is at the top of my head at the moment. We obviously, there was never a plan for a sequel for One Wrong Turn. I wrote it as a standalone. I kind of thought the story was closed and done and dusted and was working on other things. And I'm very, very fortunate. There's been a bit of a ballet buzz in Australia with One Wrong Turn. We've got a very big dance community. So Kate, my publisher Kate, just said to me, you know, after the book was already out, what do you reckon about a sequel? I think we would be silly not to jump on this. And I said to her, Kate, that's, yeah, 100%. Of course, if you tell me to, I'll do it. But you've always said, you know, sequels have to be within 12 months, kind of a little bit more if we want to, but ideally 12 months. And I thought, you know, how long have I got to do this? And she's like, well, it's going to be tight. She's like, I'll send you a timeline and we'll just see if you think it's doable. We hung up the phone and I was like, okay, I just, in case I need to think this through, what could I do? What would my ideas be? And so a couple of days later, an email came through and I'd already started, because I was just thinking, I don't have time to waste. I know it's going to be tight. And tight was 2 months for a first draft.
Wow.
And I'm very much, if an opportunity like this comes along, I will jump, I will make it happen. And so I'm like, yeah, Kate, 2 months, no worries. That's 100% fine. Thankfully, I am very deadline driven from media work. Also, doing One Wrong Turn originally, although it was over a long space of time, within that, I would always set myself deadlines and they were always quite brutal. And I was always really strict and very unforgiving with myself. I'm awful to myself. So I was like, 2 months is actually okay. Kate just said first draft. I think that's a loose term and I didn't want to. She was like, we know we've got flexibility. We'll talk closer to the date if you need more time. And I'm like, absolutely not. If you are giving this to me, I'm going to make it happen, but I don't want to give her my first draft. So I originally set myself the target of having that done I think it was 2.5 weeks or so before it was due, so I had time to edit. I went a bit faster than that and kind of treated it like NaNoWriMo. And so wrote the first draft in a month. I've just finished it the other day. And now I'm going to go through and really, like, as I was going, I was already thinking, oh, I need to put that back in the beginning. That'll help. And I just jot it down. So now I'll go through and really flesh it and try and make it as strong as it can be to give to Kate, because I know then that that will influence, I guess, our release date and what is achievable in terms of the edits we do together in the time period.
That is so inspiring. I'm so impressed.
Thank you. It might not be to... when you read it. You might go straight out the hot mess, because I'm very much a, I just go like a bull at a gate. This time I don't usually plot my work. I usually have a slight premise. I'll think about it a lot. I don't stop thinking and kind of go into things. But with this one, because it was so tight, I wrote a bit of a synopsis and I also gave that to Kate, and just so she knew I was serious and I was thinking about it. And it's actually helped a lot. It's given me, as I'm going, I'm like, okay, this is what I'm working towards. This is what's driving this character. It's helped because I'm working with the same characters, so I already know their families, their setup, what's going to send them over the edge. So, of course, I'm just throwing fireballs at them in a dance premise. And, yeah, I hope I can do it.
Well, that's very exciting, and I'm sure there'll be many readers looking forward to that. Sinead, before I let you go, can you share with us the advice that has been most useful for you as a writer, or perhaps that you share when you're working with young writers as well?
I think it is definitely that figuring out what your priorities are and making them, because that has been a real game changer for me, because it is so accurate what that colleague said to me about everyone being busy and you just make the time for the things that are important. So even now I have people say to me, oh, I want to write a book, but I'm too busy. I've got a kid. I've got a full-time job. I'm like, yeah, okay. Do you watch Netflix at night? Do you scroll through your phone? Because it's not necessarily setting aside 2 hours to write. Sometimes it's 20 minutes here. It's just little bits, whatever you can piece together. And it doesn't have to be doing that every single day. It's just moving things forward at a pace that you're comfortable with. And I think that's really important. But then at the same time, on the flip side, the advice I'm still trying to teach myself is to be a little bit more balanced and a bit more kind to yourself, because I've had days where I laugh about the juggle being, I laugh about the juggle being absolutely manic. But when I would set myself deadlines and goals that I wanted to be achieve things by, and everything was in nap time, there's not often a day of the week where I am just sitting down in nap time. And although nights for me, I do try and kick back and watch some TV, the day's been that full on that I'm just completely burnt out. And there have been days where my poor husband has to deal with so much. I'll go to him teary during nap time and say to him, I really am wrecked and I can't even, I want this so badly that I just need to suck it up and I need to go sit down, because no one's making me do this. I'm making myself do this, but I really want to achieve it. So I can't even complain because it's self-imposed. Mm. But I think it's that balance. Like, I am really learning now that you can only go like a bull at a gate for so long. The industry moves very slowly. So sometimes it's really rush, and then just wait. And so I'm like, you know, sometimes I'm better off slowing down and actually delivering something that is better. But it's advice I'll give to other people. I haven't mastered it at all.
Oh, but I love that you're sharing it with us and being very generous and frank in that sharing. Sinead Maripodi, what about a recommendation of a debut book anytime, any place?
I'm going to give you two, even though you haven't asked for two.
That's
because
okay.
This year we've got one that I really love, which is Grace Notes by Karen Comer. I had never read a verse novel before. Grace Notes is a stunning introduction to a verse novel if you never have. It's just fabulous. It's brilliant. And this is a debut novel that isn't out this year, but I read it this year because it had been on my to-be-read pile for so long, because my podcast read pile was much higher.
Yes.
Girl 11 by Amy Suter Clark. She has since released a second book, but Girl 11, oh my goodness, if you like psychological thrillers, it is phenomenal. Oh my goodness, it was so worth the wait.
It's a really good one. Very, very impressive. I loved Girl 11 and very much enjoyed the latest one too, Lay Your Body Down.
Lay Your Body Down, yeah.
Sinead Maripodi, thank you so much for joining us. If readers are keen to find One Wrong Turn, find out more about you, where can they find you?
They can find me on Instagram, Twitter, or my website. Everything is Sinead Maripodi, which that is a challenge in itself, because it's C-H-E-N-E-E-M-A-R-A-P-O-D-I. If you get the Shanae and type M, I'm pretty sure I'm the only one that comes up.
That's fantastic. And we'll put links to those spots in our show notes as well. Good luck for the rest of the sequel editing, Shanae Maripodi, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Another new writerly podcast that I have been listening to is the brand new one from writers Fiona Taylor, a friend of the pod, Joe Dixon, who we've also spoken to, and Jack Ellum. It's called The Word Count, and it's only a couple of episodes in so far, but the basic idea is that, you know, Joe Dixon already published, her first book came out at the start of this year, I think. We interviewed her about it, and she's got more on the way. Fiona Taylor, very well known for being a massive industry supporter. Her and her literary husband, Brendan, come to so many events, but Fiona Taylor also does the Reading by Candlelight podcast, and she is an emerging writer. So she's working on her own manuscript. Jack Ellum, broadcaster, podcaster, also writing, not yet published. So the idea of this podcast, the setup, is it's basically an accountability podcast. So they check in with each other every fortnight about what they are planning to get written in the next fortnight, and then check back in and see if they'd actually hit their targets. So really interesting. In the first week, and I won't give away whether or not they hit their targets, but in the first episode, for instance, Joe Dixon, who is currently working on, I think, book 3 and 4, book 2 is already put to bed and ready to come out next year.
Oh my God.
I know, had set a 15,000 word target that's what she was going to write. Like, and she says, I'm writing full time, you know, I've got grown up kids, this is what I'm going to do. So she had set that. I think Fiona set like a maybe 1500 words, and Jack set like that she was going to mow the lawns. She's the procrastinator of the three, but also maybe that's 500 awesome. Words. So really impressive to see three different writers paired together who have very different kind of aims, but the way they check back in on their accountability and talk about how they fit things in around their lives, really, really great. Also, because Jack obviously works in broadcasting, she's pulled some strings to get some radio people to do like the intros and outros, and they are so brilliant and very, very pleasing to listen to. So highly recommend The Word Count, and for people to set up that's one of the things I recommend the most to writers who ask me, you know, how to get the writing done, is setting up kind of accountability frameworks, whether that's emails, whether it's, you know, checking in with a writing group, just planning what you're going to do, whether or not you reach that goal. Very, very powerful stuff. So
have you ever read any Gretchen Rubin around the Four Tendencies?
Oh, maybe through Brooke McCallery. I have. Tell me more.
Just in terms of that accountability. So she has, she classifies people into four different types. But she looks at, or one of the things that I remember of it is the way, I guess accountability is maybe not 100% the right word, but say if you want to do something, the levers and mechanisms that will hold you to account. So there's a type that's like, they're called an upholder, that just has an internal measure of, like, finds it easy to hold themselves to an account.
Yes.
To account. But there's one called an obliger that really needs a external and often relationship-based thing to hold themselves to
that
account.
Is me. Yeah. Miss Obliger over here. But once you know these things, they're...
Yeah, well, it's perfect. The that if you know that of yourself, that mechanism is really effective. Yeah.
Very good. I had one more book that I want to give a shout out to. It's a bit cheeky because I got a very early version and it's not out until January 2024, but I want people to put on their TBR list, or I don't know, flag it where you want to buy it or pre-order it.
Can you pre-order this far out? Maybe you can.
Yeah, I think you probably can. The book is the new one from Karen Viggers, whose books you may have read before. We've spoken to her on the podcast. She also co-hosts Secrets from the Green Room podcast, which we talk about often with writer Irma Gold. So Karen's new one is called Sidelines. It'll be released in January 2024 by Allen and Unwin. It is so good. I read it in kind of one sitting. The premise is that we start with an unnamed person in the middle of a football / soccer pitch who is down and out with an ambulance arriving. And that's the kind of setup, and everyone standing around the whole community, both the players and the parents, looking very sheepish. And then we go into a multi-perspective story that looks at different families whose kids are playing in this under 13s soccer team, both boys and girls. It's quite a high performing soccer team. I don't think it's just because I am a sports parent that this book hits so hard. It is about power. It's about parents behaving badly. It's about gender and sport.
It feels very slappy. Is it got a resonance of that?
A little bit, yeah, a resonance of that. Very, I think it's like Moriarty or Jodi Picoult at their best in terms of that kind of really breaking down the motivations, the relationships within that are occurring within a community. But I just think it's so well done. Karen often has written kind of nature-based, environmental-based stories. She's very, very good at that. I was so impressed to see how effortlessly she's moved into this kind of
space. Feels like a very different book for her.
Yeah, but clearly, and I haven't spoken to her about the kind of background to it, but clearly informed by, you know, parenting experiences and being part of this world too. You know, January is always a good time and a hard time for books to come out because it's in the middle of the summer holidays. But if you are part of, particularly if you are part of a kids' sporting community, you know, flag this for your book club for getting around and reading it and starting next year. I think this will be very popular. Perfect. And it will start a lot of conversations. So that's Sidelines by Karen Viggers, one to look out for in early 2024.
I'm going to add that to my list. I start as the coach of Oscar's basketball team tomorrow.
Oh,
I'm so excited.
My goodness. I am so excited for you.
Desperate.
Yeah. You've been waiting for this moment.
I have totally been waiting. Oscar's team has had a great coach who's a PE teacher already, so I couldn't really step in. But now because they've gone up an age group, well, he hasn't gone up an age group, but the coach has gone up with half the team, there was a vacancy and I'm in.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, tell me what's your philosophy going to be?
Oh, I don't have a philosophy. Right, I've got to work on that. I did run training on Monday and I told the boy, they're so cute. Like, I thought I would much prefer girls, but Carney's already coaching Tilly's team. They're really cute. Anyway, I told them about, I think I went a bit
high level.
High level. I told them about some research that came out of America.
How old are they, Catherine?
They're 8. Yeah. So, and half of them have not played before, half of them had. So I sat them down, we did everyone's name, and then I told them about this research from America. And it's actual research. I can't remember what university it's from. It was on the Mel Robbins podcast, and it looked at some of the characteristics of top performing teams in the NBA. At this point, I realized I was losing them. So I mentioned the Chicago Bulls. I said the LA Lakers. So I got a few nods. So I said the top performing teams versus the bottom performing teams. And they found that there was one thing that all of the top performing teams did that the lower performing teams didn't do. And it was that they gave each other a lot of high fives. This is not made up. Like, it's an actual research.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, every single time one of you gets a high five, one of you gets a goal at training, at least one other person needs to give them a high five.
I love that. Honestly, I loved it.
I thought it was great. Barely a high five.
Didn't land. That you put it into practice. I think.
Yeah.
You know, when you just, we'll have to have dinner, and you and Adam Carney can talk about basketball training because Adam spends so much time preparing for training and watching.
I love drills hearing that. And I've started watching drills.
Oh my gosh!
I went down early to watch someone else's training session.
Okay, you need to start a WhatsApp thread.
I can't believe how excited and how happy it's making me. Like, I'm really pleased. I need a jacket though. I feel like I need a.
Don't you get a coach t-shirt?
I don't have
coach t-shirts.
I wanted like an Adidas in the team colours. Too much.
Just ask the club for your coach t-shirt because everyone wears them around with total pride in our competition. Other than your first basketball coaching, which I'm wishing you all the love and luck for, what have you got coming up? Anything we need to come up and see you doing?
Nothing we need to promote. I'm hosting Claire Fletcher tonight, but that is the night of recording and not the night of podcast release.
That's true. I'm so looking forward to that. I am going to get in a bunch of things that I'm super excited about. These are all on my website, but worth mentioning because I get to go road tripping with Amy Lovett the day after our literary lunch. Amy and I are taking off to the Bass Coast. We're going to Nice Stack of Books in Menin. We're actually appearing at the Footy Club, very topical, talking about Amy's debut book, Mistakes and Other Lovers, which I'm rereading at the moment and absolutely loving, and The Hummingbird Effect. So you can book for that event. We're also going to pop in to a new bookstore, or new to me, I didn't know about, The Hare and the Tortoise in Currumburra. So we will be popping past there. Then I am taking my sister and my mum on tour with me, my new favourite thing to do, take the family, in Lutruwita, Tasmania. And I'll be at Fuller's Bookshop in Hobart on Thursday, 19th of October, and Petrarch's in Launceston on Friday the 20th, and doing a bunch of bookstore visits in there. So if you are in Tassie, please do come along if you can get to those places. I muscled my way in, Catherine, where I probably shouldn't have been, into the Historical Novel Association conference, where I'm going to be appearing on a panel called Past, Present and Future about bending genres. So that is in Sydney on the 22nd of October, but it is online as well. So if you can't make it, you can make a booking to view it online. And then, very excitingly, I get to talk to Holly Ringland herself about her new book, The House That Joy Built, for readings on Wednesday, the 25th of October. It's in the All Nations Church. I have been to so many events there. I have never
interacted with someone there. That means you crunched big time. You got such a crowd, or anticipated crowd, that you've been bumped from the bookshop.
Yeah. So that will be, for people who've seen Holly in Combo, she is a delight. I can guarantee you that we will cry at some point. There'll be laughter. Highly recommend you book for that one ASAP, because that will sell out. And my last one, where I get to talk to Tamara O'Dine from the ABC News, because she is a Westie local and she is hosting me for my event with the Sun Bookshop on the 28th of October at 3 p.m. So I'm so excited because I'm such a fangirl of Tamara.
That's a lovely bookshop too.
Yeah.
It's a really nice one. Quick question. So your sister and your mum, have been around when you've done a few events. Do they actually come now, or are they so bored?
So I'm very sure that my sister will be. I love her dearly. She'll probably come anyway. But mum, of course, is, you know, just totally filled with pride, keeps saying that it doesn't matter how many events she goes to, it's still interesting to her. But I have tried to, I'm just putting together the itinerary at the moment, and I am trying to make sure that there are options in the itinerary for them not to come along with me to all the events. But there are some lovely folk we know down in Tassie who will be coming to those events. So opportunities for drinks and catch-ups, which will be fun. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.